This is an interview with Howard Adams, recorded at Tecumseh Center, University of California, Davis, on April the 16th, 1980.
Yeah. Sometimes also the thing is in talking that you wander off a little bit too far and you get...
Oh, that's no problem.
Yeah, because
you can always take it out again.
Yeah, this is not for broadcast over the radio or
right,
something.
Right. No, I'll probably transcribe it and see what I can use.
Yeah, use what
you... I'll let you know about it.
What you use and what...
I'm not using it against you.
I guess I don't worry about that anyway.
Uh-huh. No, that's what we were talking about yesterday. Well, perhaps you could tell people, and it's going to be mostly German listeners, something about where you were born, how you were raised, and I understand you lived on the reservation for a long time of your life. But you left the reservation, and you're a professor of Native American studies now. And wherever you'd like to start.
Yeah. Is it running now?
It's running.
Oh.
It is running.
I was born in Saskatchewan, Canada, and I guess that is sort of rather precise for a lot of people, in at least here in the United States. But more specifically, I was born in a place in northern Saskatchewan, which is really the battleground area of the last great Indian war in Canada. And in that area are almost exclusively Indians and what we call in Canada half-breeds.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really an official word, half-breed. That means a white father and an Indian mother. Now, the thing is that, as I say, I lived in this area, which is a reservation area that covers a very large geographical area,
mm-hmm.
because of the Indians that migrated to the area in Saskatchewan after the first Indian War in 1880 in Manitoba. And so they were chased out by the white people and by the military of the Ottawa regime. And then the Indians settled in Saskatchewan, and then eventually the military and the regime from Ottawa once again wanted to start expanding further west and take over more land, as the case does with the industrial white society. And so they had to once again go to war with the Indians in order to capture the land. And that meant they went to war with the Indians who were my ancestors.
Is that the Louis Riel?
Louis Riel, exactly.
Riel.
This is what in Canada they refer to that as the Louis Riel rebellions.
Yeah, of course.
But that's understandable because the people who wrote those histories were really white historians and what I call bourgeois historians, because that means they concentrate on personalities. And also the further reason for concentrating on the personality is that they are then able to take the focus off the real issue, which was really economics. It, after all, they wanted the land, they wanted the resources, mm-hmm. and it took the heat off the fact that, that the government was not really the aggressor and the invader. That by focus on Louis Riel, they are able to say, well, this was because it was the work of a madman or the work of a man who had the capacity to organize the Indians into a real Indian war and attack the white settlers and prevent the society from developing and expanding and so on, and so that they really had to crush them. And that kind of bourgeois interpretation has persisted until, I would say very recently, until one of the major turnarounds, and that was my own book on writing about and discrediting and showing that it was not really Louis Riel a personality war.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a war over the resources and the land and the expansion of the industrial ruling class in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the area where I was born, and that's, let's see. Pardon?
When was that?
When?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the last war was...
No, I mean, when were you born?
Oh, when was I born?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was born during the Depression years.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it was a very difficult time economically. It's a difficult time economically for anyone on reservations, but this was particularly difficult because at least that was even the earlier part of the Depression, and so that I can remember not only vaguely but rather vividly, even though I was young, the extremes of hunger and you know, the kind of almost starvation and the terribly hard times that we had. And it was really extreme, and that's why I grew up being rather hostile and sort of, you know, violent towards the society because of the kind of conditions that I saw that or had experienced. And people, Indians growing up in other times, like today, would not probably experience such extreme conditions as we did. And living in
a... Can you give some sort of examples to so that people can... What it looked like, what the problems were?
Yeah, well, we lived in the typical two-room log shack, and where we just had planks for a floor, and it was the walls were mudded with you know, just ordinary sticky mud and manure and straw, and a mud roof, and the thing is that we had no electricity, and no running water. You know, it was extremely primitive, and we lived in, it's a little bit north of, in the area of Canada even, so that it is extremely primitive. Primitive in the most extreme conditions that you can think of. And one has to appreciate that this is also, when you think of the weather, that in the, you get very long winters, and weather, climate that goes, or temperatures that go as low as 40, 50 below for long periods of time. So that, that is very extreme and very difficult times to live in. And so that, you know, it's difficult living in those small little crowded log shacks with, you know, the most inefficient and awkward way of heating them and of keeping alive in them as well under those extreme temperatures. And then the kind of food that we ate was largely, you know, the kind of food that the government might ration out to us, or that we could do on our own hunting. Basically, the kind of food that we had was largely what we call bannock. And here, I noticed the Indians down here call it fry bread. And bannock is simply made of flour and salt and baking powder and I don't know what else, few other... Practically no protein at all in it, and then we had our own gardens, and you know, little garden, because it was, those were the years of the severe drought, so that we had very little garden, but we would grow potatoes and a few vegetables and things like that, and then what we lived on in the winter time would be the things that we caught, like rabbits. Generally, there were a lot of rabbits, and do a little bit of hunting like that, and. So that it was a time of extreme sort of conditions in terms of hunger, and I know that you know, the pain that goes with that, because that I used to see these expressions and see and hear the kind of discussions that went on with my mother and father in terms of how we were going to live, and it was from day to day, and. You are faced with a situation that could easily be that you may very well be starving tomorrow, because there were people who starved to death in our area, and that is not so unusual. So you went to the funeral. You carried his, your friend to his grave. He was your school pal, but he died. He died of maybe pneumonia, but the thing is, he died of starvation. And you went to a lot of funerals because of these kinds of conditions, and you never knew when your turn might be up. Because there just was not that kind of food available. There's nowhere that you could turn to get food, unless I say you really hunted it and you had to get out and hustle it. You probably didn't have adequate clothing to stay out for very long, and you didn't have the right kind of hunting gear to really track down animals that took a long time. So that, you know, it was really a very desperate situation. And I stayed in that reservation for on the first 20 years of my life. I was actually just 20 when I left it. But
did
the reason
go to school, eh?
Yes, the thing is that there was an elementary school in that area, and so it meant that the Indian kids were able to go to an elementary school, and some of us did, not too many, and I was one that went as far as grade 8, actually as far as grade 9, because the teacher who was there I thought was really a good teacher, and also that I would like to, you know, liked him well enough to continue as long as possible with him. So he sort of...
Was he a white teacher?
He was a white teacher.
Were there any Indian teachers?
No, there were never any Indian teachers, no, no. And I think that's how I got...
What language was spoken?
Only English.
Only English. And yeah. The people on the reservation, did they speak English or Cree?
They spoke a combination, because... It's rather an unusual kind of reservation in that sense, because they are descendants of the French fur traders.
Oh yeah, the Cour de Bois.
Right. So that they had really a kind of a patois, which was something between French, English, and Cree.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, like the old timers, spoke Cree, primarily Cree.
Mm-hmm.
And also others spoke, well, I would say that they spoke Cree and French.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became a patois. My generation was definitely a patois, and was that combination. And then I only learned English properly, if I even speak it properly today, is after I got into mainstream.
Uh-huh.
And my brother and sisters stayed in that area and still live there, and they still speak, to a large extent, the patois that that we did at that time. And I was the only one that went on to get education from our family or from most of the whole total reservation, because they all dropped out, just as my brother did. He dropped out at grade 5 because, you know, there's just no interest in going to school and they don't have to go to school. And
they don't have, it's not compulsory.
It is now.
It is now, but yeah. It wasn't then.
It wasn't then, no.
So it was really an effort on the parents' side to keep kids in school, I guess. Huh?
It was, which?
It was an effort on the parents' side to keep them in school, I mean, to provide for them that long.
Yeah, uh-huh. But the thing was, there wasn't, in those days, there was really not an emphasis on school or education in our area. That was not important. School education was just not considered important.
Yeah.
Earning a living and being able to trap and hunt and fish and do whatever is necessary to keep alive was more essential.
Yeah.
Those were the important things about life there. And that's why my brother quit at grade 5 and went, stayed home and helped my dad make a living. And when I continued to go to school, in fact, my father was very, very much opposed to it, because he felt that my place was earning a living, helping to keep the family alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very much against me going to school. And fortunately, though, my mother was in favor of me going to school and continuing at school. And the other big factor was that the teacher at the school, although he was white, was very partial to me and favored me very much. And
why did he favor you?
Well, I now know why. I did never understood in those days, see, because the fact was that it just seemed to me that I was kind of a favorite, and I sort of recognized it a little bit. I don't think I abused it too much, but I knew that situation, and I suppose maybe because some students would call me the teacher's pet and so on, but now I understand, because I look white, and that I now understand that we live in a white racist or a white supremacist society. And the fact that I probably looked the whitest of all the kids at school, and therefore that teacher, because he's white, was more partial and favorable to me, simply because he was more comfortable with me, that I looked more like him, that I probably started to adopt my lifestyle as more in his fashion, and that I started to talk maybe in a way that was more consistent with his language, and as a result he felt much more comfortable with me. and as
I've
a result,
heard similar things from other people who Indian people who look white, that they have the same experience. That's why I asked.
Yes.
It seems to be a really common pattern.
It is a common pattern. Mm-hmm. And now I have, since just within the past 2 years, I have read research reports on this, where
mm-hmm.
where blacks or Chicanos have made statistical studies
mm-hmm.
in this regard about skin color and life chances or life
mm-hmm.
opportunities, and it bears out in what I say subjectively, and so now I can fully understand it and appreciate it. And I used to think later on in life, when I got back in Saskatchewan and became involved in the civil rights movement, is that was the first question the white people always used to ask me when I would be making a public speech, is how did you manage to get a university education if you came from a situation like that?
Mm-hmm.
And at that time I really didn't understand it, and I couldn't explain it too well.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, well, I don't know, you know, probably was just a kind of a freak, an accident or something like that. But I fully understand the whole situation
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see also by extending, the teacher extended sort of privileges to me and favors to me, so that I liked being at school and with him, because it also gave me a certain status
yeah.
over the other students, which in our society, the male person does not have much esteem or status, because, you know, you are so seriously inferiorized
mm-hmm.
that you have no status.
Yeah.
So that this is something really important, and you feel great about it.
That would normally also fall into this mechanism of buying off some people.
Oh, yeah.
To rule their own people.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes,
so,
because...
But that didn't work out.
No, it didn't work out. But it kept me at school enough that what it did
mm-hmm.
was that it instilled an interest in me
mm-hmm.
For continuing at school. And I would probably say that it was not that I was really interested in education per se. I was interested in going to school at that time because of all the kind of activities that I was able to participate in, and was in a sense able to dominate over a lot of other students
mm-hmm.
and get a certain amount of status and so on within the society.
Mm-hmm.
And then also that the reputation kind of would spread in the community that Howard had done this and done that, and he was further ahead in sort of the track meet, and he had done better in sort of his examinations than the other students, and so on. And that gave me a certain status. Also, the other thing is that our own home life was so wretched in terms of living conditions and in terms of food and everything else, also in terms of getting along, because there was a hell of a lot of hassle. My mother and father didn't get along, and that's understandable, because the fight was a lot over just over economic conditions. And generally, you know, it was a disturbing and a disruptive kind of society at home. So that when I went to school, I was free of that. And while I was at school, it was to me, it was a fairly pleasant condition. And usually the school was warm and comfortable in wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I'm sure that was an escape, and that was one of the reasons. Also, my mother was anxious that I should go to school.
Mm-hmm.
So that, fortunately, I say I finished what was my grade 9, and there. And then after that, the other real fortunate part about it was that I had the good sense to go on to high school in the little town, which was about 3 miles away,
mm-hmm.
and the high school was really the Roman Catholic convent.
Mm-hmm.
And since we were Catholics, that was a kind of a tie for me, once again, to be able to just simply go to the same Catholic high school, which was adjacent to the Catholic church that we went to.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and it was an encouragement by...
Were there any other kids from the reservation, Indian kids who went to the high school?
No.
You were the only one?
I was the only one, right. I was the only one.
How did that work out?
It worked out really quite well, because I found that at the convent is a very unique situation.
Mm-hmm.
At a normal high school, I think I would have encountered difficulty
mm-hmm.
and may have dropped out, because I probably would have run up against white kids and probably would have, because there's a lot of racism in that little town. It was just really one of the most redneck towns you can imagine, and I know that because of the treatment I got as a kid in there.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime I'd go to town and
what's the name of that town?
St. Louis.
Uh-huh.
It's St. Louis, L-O-U-I-S, but mm-hmm. because it's French, it's St. Louis.
Yeah.
And so that, and it's very, very redneck, and as I said, the kind of racist treatment the against us as Indians was severe.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been in the high school. There was a little high school there, but I didn't go to that. I went to the convent, and at the convent it was all right because the situation was whereby the girls were of course allowed only on one side in the convent, and also in the classroom they were over on the other side, and there were only about two or three boys in the high school,
mm-hmm.
and we were over on the other side, and they happened to be the other two or three, I can't remember how many, there was a few of us,
mm-hmm.
that they were not types that were involved in any kinds of things like what racism was, although they were white students. They
mm-hmm.
were, you know, rather deep into Catholicism, and they were probably going on to be priests and things
mm-hmm.
like that. So as a result, they never noticed were not affected by anything that was sort of racist. They were deeper into other things that were took them off into that area.
I'm surprised. I never knew you went to a convent too.
How did
that affect you? I think.
Well, I would say that by that time, I guess I had grown up and had enough ideas of my own, and I was a fairly aggressive person, and as I say, in the elementary school I was kind of a dominant type
mm-hmm.
of individual, and so when I went to the convent I was wasn't accepting of a lot of
mm-hmm.
the kind of theology they would and catechism that they would throw on you and so that I had difficulties to some extent, because one thing is I just wouldn't take the catechism, and there were kind of rules that I thought were, you know, they're very,
you
very rigid.
Confession and all that.
Yeah,
it's not
right.
Part of the curriculum. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I kind of rebelled against that because I felt that, you know, I should run my own life to some extent. And
did your parents help you in any way, or the your community?
No.
They were all Catholics, right?
Oh yeah, they were all Catholics. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, the only thing that we had to pay. We had to pay a little bit, you know, to go to the for me to go to the convent.
Mm-hmm.
But what we did was, in those days, you could pay by taking in cordwood. You know, you
mm-hmm.
could cut wood
mm-hmm.
and take it to the convent and pay in payment for what they charge you for. And because they burned wood in
mm-hmm.
To heat their convent.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we paid, was through cutting wood, take it to there.
Actually, I didn't mean the paying, I meant sort of spiritually, that they backed you up when you were sort of critical of concepts.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah,
mm-hmm.
they did.
Mm-hmm.
Both my mother and father, yeah, they would...
They were pretty critical
yeah.
of the thing, too.
Yeah, they were, yeah, right. They mm-hmm. would back me up. And the thing is, I did get into trouble periodically, to be sure, with Mother Superior. And Mother Superior, different times, called me down into her office and would really lay down the law to me and tell me that, you know, I couldn't do this and couldn't say that, and that they were, you know, very sort of, what would you say, suspicious and very much on top of me, because they felt that that I might influence the other students in whatever I would say. You know, I don't know what I would say, but regardless, that if it would might be anti-Catholic or it might be against the convent or the way things were being run or something like that.
Were they all nuns?
Oh yes, absolutely. Oh,
mm-hmm.
everyone was a nun by all
means. I talked to two other people who also went to Catholic schools, and they said that the nuns there were really sort of fierce.
Oh yes.
In regards to punishment or something.
Oh.
But this really taught them not to believe in Christian love.
Yeah. Oh, they were. Very, very severe. Of course, you know today that the nuns in the Catholic Church have become much more liberalized and everything. They don't even have to wear their garb anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, they were absolutely of the medieval period. Like when we used to go down into the basement to have lunch, and you were not allowed to even to whisper. Now, you know, you could never talk, you could never whisper or say a word, and you had to eat in absolute silence. And there used to be a nun who would sit on a high stool in the center, and she has to have a kind of a long whip, and in case you whispered, then she'd really wrap you with it. And that's how severe they were. And so that, you know, they treated, and it was just like a medieval, you'd go down into the basement in the bowels of the earth, and they were really brutal. And but nevertheless, I felt that they taught you well, mm-hmm. Fairly thoroughly in terms mm-hmm. of the academic word. Mm-hmm. Because I came out of there with my grade 12, and I think I really had a good grasp of the academic work. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, I must say that I had really a very good math teacher. And although I never excelled and went on to do anything in math after that, and today math is a problem for me. But nevertheless, I finished grade 12, which was wise. Oh, okay. Because then, you see, well, I was about 19 when I finished high school. Mm-hmm. Because the thing is, we don't start school. We didn't at that time, and I don't think they do even today, start school until you're about 8 or 9 years old, mm-hmm. because you have a long way to go to school.
Yeah.
And so that, and you go, you know, usually by a grade each year, so it mm-hmm. takes you a long time to get through,
yeah.
and you're always late. And that's why a lot of the kids drop out, because they don't want to be going to school when they're 18 and 19
right.
years of age. But I stayed with it until I finished when I was 19, and then I left then the reservation, we call them reserves in Canada,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Shortly after. And I went into mainstream society, into a city, but it wasn't a very big city. It was close, it was only about 20 miles from the reservation, and I went in the city and got sort of just manual laboring jobs. But I found that was typical of most Indians, in that I just couldn't stand the shock of being in an urban situation which was so totally unfamiliar and out of harmony with what a reservation was. And as a result, I would quit my job and go back to the reservation.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd get back home, and I was much more comfortable and happier and much more satisfied about everything. And then I would get restless after a few months again, because there's nothing to do on the reservation. And so I'd go back into the city again and get another job and work at it. I did that 3 times before I was able to finally make it in ministry. And while I was in the city, I would, trying it like that, I would find that I was extremely lonely, number one, and that I felt that, you know, the urban society intimidated me very greatly.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I guess at times I was not associated with the Indians, because maybe the area I was living or something like that. But the thing is that when I look back on it now, that where I went to live in the city when I arrived there was in what's called Skid Road, where the Indians live. And I didn't even know it was Skid Road then. To me, that was just a place to live where the Indians were.
Yeah.
I never thought of it as a Skid Road. And I guess then, what happened, I suppose, after that is that I was there long enough to work at various jobs and eventually became satisfied with regard to urban way of life enough that I could stay with it and work at a job. And they were, as I say, very menial, manual laboring jobs. I remember one job I had at a big hotel of washing garbage cans exclusively. Mm-hmm. And things like that. And eventually I got so that I think I was quite satisfied with the mainstream society. And then I suppose the kind of unique situation happened after that, and I can't recall, it's so long ago, but it seems to me what really made me sort of leave the reservation and leave my Indian way of life was I became involved with a blonde girl that I thought was extremely beautiful, very attractive, and I fell in love with. And, you know, I look back on and start analyzing the situation.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was kind of a sort of a takeoff point for me, that why did I suddenly
mm-hmm.
become so engrossed and involved?
That's what you wrote yeah, about.
Wrote about, yeah.
Book, right.
And
that's probably a common experience of all racial minorities. If you think, I think it's Eldridge Cleaver who writes.
Yeah.
That I wrote about that.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah.
When I look back and analyze it, mm-hmm. I think that was the turning point, because that, you know, the love for her was so intense that it was all engrossing in my life, and I forgot about the reservation and forgot about my own parents and everything. And then,
were you ashamed of the reservation then?
Well, then I started to be, right. Once you see that I became sort of urbanized to some extent, and then I started this love relationship with this girl, and of course she was very much opposed to Indian way of life, and although she was she was fond of me, and I would say eventually she probably was very much in love with me, but at the same time she rejected my Indianness and made that very definite. So that was always a dilemma with me, but nevertheless the thing is that the love for her was strong enough that, you know, I followed her. And so she made a decision that she was going to go to Vancouver, which is directly across Canada,
mm-hmm.
on the opposite side of where I was living. And I followed her. I went with her. That was an agreement. And so I went with her. And so this was a whole new experience once again, was that I was now in another part of the world within Canada, though,
mm-hmm.
but thousands of miles away from a reservation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was here that I totally severed all connections with the reservation. And, you know, I now thought of the reservation in my mind as a place of some place that was, you know, really a horrible place, a place of disgrace and utter